Blog Talk Radio.
With Stu, I'm your host on this 7 November 2017 election day, and we've got a really good show here tonight for you. Something I've wanting to been talk about a long time, and I got two individuals on tonight that I think are going to be very interesting in talking about healthcare. Certainly a topic of interest in this country, has been for some time. Some are pretty happy with where we're going, say with the Affordable Care Act. Others think that it's, you know, the end of the world. But, you know, I think tonight we want to talk, see maybe if there's some different ways we can look at the problem. And it's a little bit of a setup. Commonwealth Fund periodically comes out with rating the healthcare systems in the U.S. So just some things I'm going to throw out here about their findings, and then I'll throw some counters out, and then we'll go from there. So the Commonwealth found that among 11 developed nations, that the U.S. healthcare system was the worst performing when they looked at it. They focused on things like care process, access, administrative efficiency, equity, healthcare outcomes, in total about 72 indicators. And the developed nations are countries you would expect, Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Netherlands, Switzerland, the UK, you know, all the usual suspects there. U.S. rated especially poor in a quality of coverage, finding that 44% of low-income Americans have trouble gaining access as compared to, say, 26% of high-income Americans, while in the U.K. those numbers would be 7% and 4% respectively. And the U.K. by this study was deemed as the best healthcare system, as it has been for a while. U.S. did rank fifth in care processes, which include prevention, safe care, coordination, patient engagement, but it was still managed to be the worst of the 11 nations. And it's the only high income nation to lack universal health care, which is of note. Now, critics will counter that study and they'll say, well, hey, you know, that's one way of looking at it, but perhaps actually in treating people once they're sick, they'll say the U.S. is the best. And they'll point out that, yes, while we spend a large share of our GDP, about 18%, on health care, we also happen to be one of the richest countries in the world. And therefore, we have what they would say is a lot of disposable income. And therefore, a lot of that's going to go to, you know, spending more on health care to keep ourselves alive because we're an affluent nation. They would also say that some of the measurements weren't fair by nature of the way things are documented, are measured. So like infant mortality rates, different countries measure that differently on what they call a stillborn, you know, counting miscarriages or not counting miscarriages. And, you know, there's just different things like that. And I can run down this list. I think one of the more interesting thing was cancer survival rates. United States, prostate cancer survival is 99%. Denmark, it's 47%. Fifth-year survival rates for breast cancer are higher in the United States than England, Denmark, Germany, and Spain, according to the American Cancer Society. So basically, there's give and take, and there's counter to all of this, and I think it's kind of hard to really make some sense out of it. Though, the one thing that both groups agreed upon was that we spend a lot of money on healthcare. It seems to be going up a lot, outpacing inflation, and that is absolutely a problem. And one thing that was in the Commonwealth study that was interesting was it said to gain more than incremental improvement, the U.S. may need to pursue different approaches to organizing and financing delivery systems. And it said these could include strengthening primary care, supporting organizations that excel at care coordination, and moving away from a fee-for-service payment or other types of purchasing that create incentives to better coordinate care. These steps should ensure early diagnosis and treatment, improve the affordability of care, and ultimately improve the health care of all Americans. Now, that last part, to me, I thought was interesting, and I think it gets buried a lot because with the way the healthcare debate works in this country, and it's sort of led by the politicians because they're the ones coming up with the solutions. But because you've got politicians and lawyers, quite frankly, up there making all of the calls, I think they focus a lot on how we're going to pay for it or who's going to pay for it. And what they don't focus upon, I think, are some fundamental questions, which is, number one, in terms of social justice, what do we want out of a healthcare system, and what do we need to provide as a means to take care of our fellow Americans? And secondly, once we determine that, what's the best way to do it and how do we do it? And then it seems to me then the question of how do we pay for it should be asked. But we focus, in my mind, a lot on how we're going to pay for this rather than how we deliver it. Now, my guest tonight are familiar faces to probably folks in the ASP and certainly in distributed circles. John Madai, a retired businessman and adjunct at the theology department, the University of Dallas, author of two books, The Vocation of Business, Social Justice in the Marketplace, and Toward a Truly Free Market, a Distributist Perspective. And he wrote an article called Distributism and the Healthcare System, which is sort of the basis of part of our talk tonight. Now, I'll also ask this, Mr. Madai, I know you write at the American Conservative. I've seen you at the Imaginative Conservative. Where else do you hang your hat when you're writing?
Oh, the Distributist Review, and anybody who's hard up for input that week.
Okay. And then, so my other guest, Dr. Matthew Loftus, and his wife Maggie currently live in Kenya, which I think is it makes you the one of two listeners we have on the continent of Africa, because it had to be you guys in Kenya that listened to one of our programs before. I was reading you guys are studying Swahili in preparation for long term service at AIC Litain Hospital in Kenya. And you guys previously worked in the South Sudan at his House of Hope Hospital, which I think is, you guys are really living what you say. How did you guys get involved in wanting to go to Africa?
I mean, it started a long way back of just feeling called by God to be part of some sort of cross-cultural ministry. And over time, it became clear that healthcare was the best way to use the gifts I had. And so, went through medical school and residency and scoped out some places and met with different teams and felt like South Sudan would be a good fit. And it was for the first 9 months, and then it was not because of security issues.
Yeah.
So we relocated now and we're studying language so I can be part of a family medicine teaching program that's just started here in Kenya.
I think that's amazing. I think that's probably a good topic perhaps for another show one day to talk just about your experience there, because I'm sure you've already got a lot to tell.
It was certainly eye-opening.
All right. So now Dr. Loftus recently gave a talk to the ASB chapter in Maryland about healthcare as well, and you can find that on YouTube. Now, he also I guess at Mere Orthodoxy is where you can find his writings, and you can even find a transcript on that, which is really great to read through. So that's who we have on tap for tonight are these two gents, and we're going to try to break down the healthcare system as much as we can in an hour and a half. I mean, if we haven't been able to fix it in 20 plus years, I don't think we're going to fix it tonight, but we can perhaps look at it a little bit differently. I'll ask both you gentlemen, I opened with the, why we're the worst, why we're the best. I mean, what's the truth there? I mean, for a guy like me who, I just go to the doctor, and I'm a retired military guy. So, for the last 20 plus years, all I've known is military medicine. Dr. Loftus, what do you think? Are we the worst? Are we the best? Are we somewhere in the middle, or is it a yes and no answer?
Well, it really depends on who you are. If you happen to have good insurance and you have some rare disease or advanced cancer, we have a lot of great resources for that. Our medical systems seem to mostly be designed to care for the worst of the worst and the weird, the odd, and the rare. Sort of the idea that, you know, we want to go as far as possible for any person who might possibly have some kind of medical problem. But what that leaves out is every person. So if we, you know, if you happen to not have insurance, then, you know, or you don't live very close to a source of healthcare, you know, a good source of healthcare, or you're having trouble making an appointment, or, you don't speak English, like at that point, you can have some kind of run-of-the-mill disease that really takes you out. And so, it's a question of what our healthcare system is for. What is, and I think that if what you want is to help whoever happens to, have the resources to get treated, live in a place, where they can get treated, then we're the best. But, if you want to pick any random person who doesn't have the resources, then, those people are really at a disadvantage compared to other countries. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Mr. Madai, would you, anything from, with your distributor's hat on and looking at it from, I guess, an economic standpoint or just the system we have, any thoughts on that question about being the best and the worst? I mean, what's stacked against us on why we're maybe underperforming?
Right. Well, I think it depends on what part of the system you occupy. So I'm retired, so I actually have socialized medicine. And for me, it works very well indeed. So we have different medical systems for different groups of people. We don't have a medical system. I think it'd be interesting, though, to start with the third question you asked, how to pay for it, and look at how we pay to it, but to whom do we pay? And how do we set the prices? Well, and it turns out that we, our medicine, first place, is we don't have ACA, Obamacare, is not a healthcare system, it's an insurance care system. And standing between every American and the doctor is a private insurance company, even to an extent for Medicare, because Part D is private insurance. So, and then we find that our medicines are delivered under a system of monopolies and oligopolies. Monopolies for things like medical equipment, hospitals, and medicines themselves are all set by monopoly or oligopoly pricing. Under monopoly pricing, you really can't provide insurance, even if insurance is a valid way of providing for insurance. But the more money you pour into a monopoly system, all you do is drive up prices. So under a market system, not a free market system, under a monopoly market system, prices only rise the more money you put into the market. So that's one of our problems. Now, Europe, they negotiate the prices. So it's not a market price system. It's sort of a negotiated price system. And that's why they don't spend what we spend. Yet, the same drug providers are more than willing to provide the same drugs for a fraction of the price that we pay for them. The same doctors are more than willing to pay to provide the same services our doctors provide, but for a fraction of the cost. So how we pay for it, the prior question is to whom we pay and how do we set the price?
Now, do you think and I'm getting a little ahead, and we'll get back to where I kind of wanted to start, but since you brought it up, do you think the Affordable Care Act, I mean, did it really change much of that? Did it kick the can down the road?
Well, I think it did neither. I think it was a lot less effective than the Democrats claim, because the biggest increase, as I understand it, in insured came through the expansion of Medicaid and not so much through the exchanges. Now, there are a few million on the exchanges, and that's a good thing. I don't want to put that down. But the big thing was the expansion of the purely socialized part of it. And so it was less effective, I think, than its backers had hoped, but too effective for its enemies, which is kind of a bad situation.
So in the end, we really, I guess you could say, we just stirred the pot a bit and we punted.
Yeah, we did. And it was, if you'll remember, all through that year that it took to pass that, what Obama was really aiming for, what he really wanted, was the public option to serve as a check on the insurance companies. The insurance companies would have to do at least as well as the public option to compete. The insurance companies felt, well, to a certain extent, that's not fair. How could we compete with government-backed programs? At the same time, that was the only way of really, unless you wanted to go to price control, as they did in Europe, that was really the only way of reining in the insurance companies. Providing an alternative to them. It still didn't address the problem of pricing, of drug pricing, of medical care pricing, and the rather arcane system we have in hospitals, which is basically a cost-plus business.
All right, well, I want to double back that back to that a little bit later, and I want to kind of keep on building up on it because, you know, we certainly have talked about, you know, where we stand, are we the best or the worst, and it's a mixed bag, which is not surprising. But let's go to the fundamental question I think needs to be asked. You know, people talk about a right to health care, and what does that even mean? Do we have a right to health care, or is health care something else? Because on one hand, if someone says a right to health care, that to some people that sounds like, you know, I can go down to the doctor and demand a facelift. It's health care. But I think we'd all agree that's not really what we're talking about. So what would a right to health care mean? And is that actually the right terminology? So, Dr. Loftus, if you could take a swing at that to start.
Yeah, I don't like the language of having a right to health care, because as you said, it's very ambiguous, it's very slippery. You are not quite, you know, you can say, you know, people can say, well, you know, anyone can walk into an emergency room at any time, and if they have an urgent medical need, it can be addressed. You know, ever since we passed EMTALA back in the 80s, like that's there, and you know, we support, you know, the government funds a lot of vaccines for children and things like that. So you know, some people could claim, yeah, you know, if you have, yeah, you have a right to health care, and we do that already through the ER. But I don't think that that's particularly comprehensive, and obviously most of the people who say we have a right to health care don't really like that, and they want something a bit more expansive, you know, something that basically covers all primary, preventive, chronic care, and emergency care. When they think about a right to health care, I think that's what they, you know, that's the asterisk on what a right to health care means. I prefer to think of health care as a social good that helps us to achieve or defend our right to life. You know, there's the I'm thinking of an episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is not a show I would highly recommend, But there was one very, very telling moment when they're, you know, one of the characters is at the hospital and they ask if the, you know, the clerk asks if they have insurance and they say, well, no, but like, you know, I'm sick. I need it. You know, if someone's, you know, robbing me, I don't pay the policeman to shoot him. If there's a fire in my house, I don't pay the fireman to, you know, come put it out. I, you know, I got to get what I need. You know, so in, you know, in other circumstances, and again, we've already accepted this when it comes to vaccines, that the, you know, that there are forces beyond our control that threaten our life and our health. And so, we collectively, work together to, both try to prevent those things from happening, you know, with police patrols and public safety programs and things like that, and, you know, the firemen who, you know, come around to your house and check and make sure you have your smoke detector is working. You know, but then they also are there in case of an emergency, and you can call them at any time. And so, I think healthcare is a social good. We can build it up in good ways and create systems that are efficient and address all of our needs holistically, or we can, you know, build it up the way we've built it, which is this Byzantine system where various monopolies and oligopolies are, you know, trying to extract as much money from each other and the government as possible. Yeah.
All right, and before I throw that over to Mr. Madai, I just want to say, folks, we did have a caller, and I know you dropped off because we were in the middle, but please, folks, call in, and you can get your questions to our guests. That number is 917-889-3030, 917-889-3030. Go ahead, Mr. Madai, you were going to pick up there.
Yes, I was. I was going to point out that this is the fundamental question that you have to answer is healthcare a common good, or as Dr. Loftus calls it, a social good, or is it a market good? Now, market good is allocated by price. Those who have more get more. A common good is social good is allocated on the basis of need. Those who need it get it. I don't know if you need to put that into a language of rights, but certainly a language of goods, of shared goods. I think without it being treated as a common good, I think you'd introduce just the kind of social pathology that we have produced. Now, these social pathologies show up a lot in those numbers that those 72 measures that the study you cited points out, but it shows up in a lot of other ways. It shows up when people go bankrupt because of medical bills, or that they just don't seek treatment because they don't feel mm-hmm. they have access to it, or they can only get the 555 care at the emergency room. My 555 plan is, you wait 5 hours to see a doctor for 5 minutes at a cost of $5. They do fall into despair, and people are nervous. I mean, if a child should get sick, if a wage earner should get sick, it does introduce a lot of social pathology into the body politic. So we have to really answer this question. Do we want to see this as a market good or as a social good? It is a social good in the same sense that roads, police, fire department, national defense, all of these things are social goods where presumably everybody has equal access, or is it a market good like iPhones? Some get the Model 10 and some get the 8 and some get nothing. That's the fundamental question we have to answer as a nation.
So I think when, you know, people talk about it being a right, I have always seen that maybe it's just a lacking in the lexicon, and they're grasping at exactly what you guys just both said, that it's a social good, but they just can't quite describe it.
Yeah, we've lost the language of social goods, because social goods are socialized goods, and socialized goods are socialism, and, well, there you go.
Right.
So we've but I think the language of social goods is probably better than the language of rights, because the language of rights, as it has developed in America, has become divorced from the language of duties. So I'm always a little bit nervous about a pure rights language, but nevertheless, a social good language, I think, is something that we can and should develop.
All right, so let's build upon lexicon a bit and defining our terms. And I'll start with you, let you continue with this, Mr. Madai. Universal health care gets thrown around a lot, and so does the term single payer. And I think quite often people use those interchangeably, or they just don't even know, I guess to them it just might even just mean, you know, like, my medicine's paid for. I don't think we really understand what those terms mean, and we use them synonymously when they shouldn't be. So thoughts on that, on those terms, if you could kind of expand on those, universal health care and single payer.
Okay, who's that directed at?
Well, that was you, Mr. Madai.
Well, that's true. A universal single payer is one way of delivering universal health care. I'm sorry, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay.
So, Mr. Loftus, or Dr. Loftus, you got some thoughts on that too, about the differences between that and what those terms actually mean?
Yeah. I mean, again, you can. There's all sorts of ways to have universal health care. People use the example of, within our own country, we have 3 or 4 different healthcare systems. So there's, so if you're a veteran and you go to the Veterans Administration, that is that's one form of universal healthcare for all veterans, similar to the NHS in the UK. There, not only does the government pay for everything, but it also runs everything. So, the doctors are technically government employees, and they pay the salaries and decide where people go and how they work and who gets what. Then, for another version of single payer is what you see in Canada, and it's sort of like the way that we run Medicare in the United States. The government pays for everything, but the government doesn't run the hospital or the doctor's offices. They don't make decisions. Everybody, there's a market out there in terms of, independent hospitals and chains and different doctor's offices and groups and things like that. But in the end, you have to comply with what the government says. And then there are other countries, mostly in Western Europe, where you have, an insurance-based system like our system, the rest of of America, and that's where you get, individuals buy their own insurance, or they get it paid for, subsidized through their work, or the government helps to subsidize what people can't pay on their own. Basically the government subsidizes it just enough such that people don't, no one falls through the cracks. The idea of universal health care is that any citizen in the country will have primary, preventative, chronic, or emergency need met as long as it's, supported by medical evidence and within reason.
So you can
single
have
payer
to jump in
the
there.
The government. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
there, I jump in there. One of the frustrating things about this debate is that there are so many working models all over the world where people have delivered universal or near universal health care through a variety of different methods. And that sort of cross-cultural, cross-transnational comparisons are just not part of the American debate, not only in this area, but in so many other areas. And it's like I've often thought that the United States of America was the world's biggest island. I mean, we have, if you live in Germany, you know what's going on in France and in Switzerland and in England. You can't avoid it. But the United States, we don't even know what's going on in Canada. And we're afraid of anything that's going on in Mexico. So we certainly don't use them as models. And it makes us, frankly, a little closed-minded. We don't take the sources of information. We don't take all of these wonderful experiments that are performed all over the world and where we can go and look at the systems and see what we like, what we don't like about them, what we could synthesize from them, what we could accept, what we could reject, etc. So we cut ourselves off from vast ranges of information, knowledge, and wisdom that are around the world, but for some reason invisible to Americans.
Would you say, Mr. Badai, though, that our system is such that for us to do that, it's almost like the American mentality is right now, and perhaps even the system, that say we look over, we look across the ocean, we decide we want to do everything like Denmark, that the mindset becomes, okay, well, let's make the United States like Denmark. Instead of, it doesn't seem like we have a system or a mindset in place where, say, three states in the Midwest could say, we're going to do it like Denmark, and break it down into smaller bites.
Yeah. In other words, invoking some kind of subsidiarity here.
Yeah. I think that we look to the federal level first, and at least for me, I become a little skeptical that we could pull off on such a scale, like in one fell swoop, some of these great experiments you're talking about on much smaller countries, whether it's in Northern Europe or it's even in Asia, because we can't pull it off like that because the system's not in place to allow us to pull it off.
Yeah. There is, I think that's great observation, because this is such a large country, and we should be able to do kind of the laboratory of the states, I think they used to call it. There is a problem, however. See, that would be very possible for Virginia, California, New York. It's a little bit dicier when you start getting to Idaho or Wyoming. I mean, Wyoming isn't as big as the city of Irving, for crying out loud. The city of Irving is a suburb. many of the areas would have to have multi-state, I think, systems. California could have multiple systems in one state. Virginia could certainly experiment on its own. But allowing that caveat, I think what you say is exactly correct. If there was some way of enabling that, there is another problem in that in the United States, the states really don't have the revenue sources that the federal government does. So the federal government can collect far more taxes than the states can, which somewhat handicaps them as laboratories. So Virginia really isn't like France or Germany. It really is, whether we care to admit it or not, a subdivision of the federal government. Wasn't designed that way, but that's sure the way it's worked out. And in the end, in politics, power follows taxing authority.
Yeah, that almost makes it sound as if you know, you're not going to get any kind of headway to get those laboratories in the U.S. until we actually take care of or formulate a tax system that maybe empowers the states and the regions more than it does now.
Yeah, bottom up rather than top down. I think that's what the Republicans are thinking in things like block grants, but they're not really willing to block grant enough to the states to do something like that.
So you're saying there's still strings attached. It's not, they don't just give the money and say, do what you want.
Well, I guess there should be strings attached if you give money, but nevertheless, they wouldn't give enough money anyway to make it work.
Oh, I got it. Right.
Yeah.
So are we left with the understanding then, you know, because since everyone wants single payer, I mean, and I say everyone and I'm exaggerating, but that's what you hear now, you know, single payer now. I mean, Is that the magic bullet for the U.S.? Is it we just go to single payer, all problems are solved?
Well, that's certainly something that has to be considered. I mean, seriously debated. And there has to be, if somebody doesn't want single payer, then they have to have some other way of reaching the idea of healthcare as a common good. Maybe other ways to do it, that's fine, but that's the debate that has to take place.
Yeah, so Dr. Loftus, I know you had in some of your writings mentioning single payer. What do you think are the advantages of going to that approach?
I mean, I think it's the simplest way to make sure everybody has access to care that they need. That's the main advantage, I would say. The disadvantage is that all of the problems that we, I shouldn't say all, because it will reduce a lot of the inefficiencies in bureaucracy that currently exist. You know, we spend four times as much on paperwork, as Canada does, just because we have so many different insurance systems. Companies and different hospitals and who's in which network and all of that kind of stuff. So we can eliminate some of those redundancies, and we can make sure that everybody has access to some kind of care. You know, obviously the question of paying for it is a bit of a sticky wicket. But then also, I think more importantly, most of the other problems in terms of the concentration of power in the hands of doctors and hospitals and the
drug companies,
drug companies and all of those dynamics are basically unchanged. Although I would imagine that under a single payer system, the government would have a lot more negotiating power with the drug companies at least, and might be able to standardize prices across hospitals. To some degree, but you still have doctors that are overpaid doing things that they're overqualified for.
Well, you know,
I think
the paying.
No, go ahead, Mr. Madai.
I'm sorry. The paying for it is less of a problem than we think because we're spending 18% of GDP. I think the next second place is like 12 or 11%. Of GDP. So we're already spending the money. And if you look at that 18%, about 9% of that, half of that, is already spent by the government. In other words, what we have is the worst of both systems. We spend as much as Canada on public health, but we don't have a public health system. We spend as much, we spend an equal amount on private insurance, but we really don't have a free market system. So it's as if we've taken the worst features of both systems and combined them into a Rube Goldberg contraption that pleases no one except those who profit from the system. And, well, with 18% of GDP spent, there's an awful lot of people making awful lot of profit off of
Dan Carlin. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Dan Carlin, and he does two podcasts. One is called Common Sense, The other is called Hardcore History. And the Hardcore History one, he goes on these marathon, like, six-hour podcasts going over some era of history. Very, very fascinating. Now, he is admittedly a libertarian, and he has made the case on one of his podcasts that strictly from, if you're, he says, if you're a conservative and you're strictly concerned about spending money, then you got to be for single payer, because we could do it for cheaper if we just paid for everyone out of the pocket right now than we're paying with the existing system. And
if you controlled costs, if you controlled drug costs, and if you could attack the hospital pricing problem, which is another scandal in the system.
I guess my concern about single payer is this. You know, being a career military officer, I just see like that we would be setting up another Department of Defense type thing. We would we'd run this big healthcare system, and then pretty soon the tail would wag the dog, and we would be spending like the DOD for healthcare. And I think with people's health comes to mind, we'd really spend. No cost would be too much when it comes to someone's health, and that's my fear of growing a very a big federalized system. I mean, thoughts on that? Am I out to lunch, or is that a concern?
No, it already happens, and it happens at the wrong time. So, as I said, I was on Medicare, and we'll find that we've invested, you are going to invest, your children are going to invest,
that's right,
an awful lot of money in the last 30 days of my life. You are going to pay out the nose for the last 30 days of my life. It is, quite frankly, a misallocation of resources. But I have more bargaining power in the market because I have the federal government behind me, and you don't.
Well,
so
fortunately, we like your book. So
who's going to win this argument? You or me?
Yeah. Well, let's. Yeah. Let's take a call right now.
Can't get anywhere.
Guys, we got a call, and last one we went running on, and the guy fled the scene, but we got a call, so let's go ahead and have him throw a question. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Charles Jenkins. Jeffrey, I think we know each other at the least. So I'm calling in as someone who knows relatively little about healthcare. It's a blind spot of mine. We were talking just, a few minutes ago about prices. And back when the AHCA was being discussed, last spring, I ran into an article that I was able to pull up, which was titled "Healthcare Will Never Be Affordable Without Action on Prices." And there was a really short entry that I wanted to read that I thought I thought was very good based on some conversations with some friends of mine who are a bit more knowledgeable. It should be clear from these examples there is no single explanation for high U.S. healthcare prices and no simple solution. Action is needed, but it needs to come across many fronts at once, against mergers, entry barriers, drug prices, lack of transparency, administrative fragmentation, and other problems. If each of these areas could eliminate a single percentage point of the gap between U.S. prices and those that prevail in our high-income tiers, we could save billions of dollars a year. Now, a friend of mine said that he said mergers would actually more mergers, acquisition, and consolidation insurance would actually be a good thing for consumers. But I wanted to discuss maybe more the issue of how exactly to address prices, because I know Jeffrey is, had expressed worry about the government, just this endlessly ballooning thing. And obviously that could I could see that happen. So how would we want to, regardless of whether it was pure single payer or it was, some other system, how could we drive down prices and or prevent a further ballooning of prices?
Jump in there, guys.
A single payer is a monopsony. So you oppose one buyer. So you oppose a monopsony to a monopoly. A single buyer sets the price, doesn't he? You know, especially if he happens to have the cops on his side. So we do what, there's models to do that. There's models in Europe. They negotiate the price. And since they're the paying the bill, they can do that. So we could easily, easily cut the costs of drugs, which are absurd. We also could provide some transparency in hospital pricing. You can't call up your hospital and find out what's the cost of, say, a normal delivery or a normal appendectomy, because there isn't one price. And even if there was, they wouldn't give it to you. So it's deliberately designed to be obscure, so there can't be any comparisons. So I think there's many ways of addressing that problem, and Charles is right, that problem needs to be addressed.
Okay. Anything else there, Charlie?
Another idea that I had seen, you know, if, you know, obviously single payer is also a very fraught issue, so it and it's also kind of a trigger word for quite a few people. So, you know, if single payer proves politically impossible, but Medicare, which has largely been accepted at least in principle, is there a way to expand Medicare in such a way as to allow them to maybe negotiate, allow them further flexibility in negotiating with insurance companies and drug companies? Because right now it seems that there's not a lot of power to do that, and it seems, you know, like that makes it very difficult.
There is power to do it, or that is, if they would do it, except for that Congress passed a law prohibiting Medicare from negotiating prices. They cannot negotiate for the drug prices. So, yeah, it can be done. All you have to do is repeal that law.
Okay. That's good. That's good.
All right, so I'll tell you what. Let's take a quick break. I don't have a lot of breaks in this show just because the topic's good. I want to. When we get back, what I want to do is we almost had to get the topic of paying out of the way, even though I started off saying that I think we talk about that too much. We almost had to get out of the way. When we get back, what I'd like to talk about is, okay, let's just say whether it's single payer or not, I'd like to get our guests to discuss well, what are some things we can do to, you know, systemically to improve the system to better deliver healthcare to people, and also to keep the population more healthy, since we've talked about it being a social good. So we'll do a short break, and then we'll be back in about a minute or so. And you're on the Day's Work podcast. Our guests, John Madai and Dr. Loftus, and we're discussing healthcare. And we'll be right back. Hey, folks, Stu here from the Day's Work podcast. Do you like what we're doing here? Are you interested in political thought and policy that doesn't fit into the typical left-right paradigm? Are you interested in providing a Christ-centered witness in the public square? Or do you support the traditional family of mother, father, and child as the foundation of our society? Do you share our call for the greatest possible autonomy for local governments? Or do you advocate for an economy in accord with the dignity of human work, ordered towards ownership and opportunity? Well, you might find yourself at home with fellow travelers like us as part of the Dorothy Day Caucus. We are an independent group of like-minded members from the American Solidarity Party. Find out more about us at our Facebook group, Dorothy Day Caucus ASP, and more about the American Solidarity Party itself at solidarity-party.org. And as I said, short break here on the Day's Work podcast. I'm your host, Stu, with Mr. John Madai, distributist, and Dr. Matthew Loftus talking about healthcare here in the States. That promo for the Dorothy Day Caucus and the American Solidarity Party. Hey, if you like the Day's Work podcast, by all means, go out and affirm us. And by that, I mean like us, like the Dorothy Day Caucus on Facebook, share the podcast, like us on Twitter. You can certainly also get the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Rate it there. Help spread the word. And you know, if you've got guest ideas or if you think you need to be on, just drop us a line. It's not that hard. So picking up where we left off, one of the things you said, Mr. Madai, is you talked about Medicare not being allowed by law to negotiate for drug prices. Now, I think that's a good segue into, one of your major recommendations to kind of make the system more distributist was it's also illegal. And that was in terms of guilds. And if you could kind of expand on that idea a little bit, and then we'll see from how the doctor, what he thinks about a system like that.
Bill, I would like to hear Matthew's take on that. But basically, a guild is an association of people involved in who come together to provide healthcare services. So you have doctors, nurses, pharmacists, technicians, all the people necessary to deliver healthcare, and they could set up basically their own system. They could train their own people, set their own standards, dispense their own medicine, do whatever it takes to deliver healthcare. And what makes it work is the requirement for insurance. So a group of could set up a healthcare cooperative. They could set their own standards, providing many different levels, from what we would call now a nurse practitioner, maybe a medical practitioner, medical doctors. And they would license them themselves. They would see to their training, license them themselves. And if somebody, they did something wrong, you would sue not the doctor, but the guild. So all the members of the guild would be responsible for everybody else. That would sort of encourage them to encourage high standards, or better, I would say, appropriate standards. That might be obviously the standards for a nurse practitioner practicing medicine is different from the standards for an MD or a medical specialist. But let them take care of all of that. That would expand the supply of medical care deliveries, expand the number of doctors, or expand the number of people who actually provided care. When you expand the supply, you bring down the cost. Being able to provide those full range of services, they could experiment in whatever way they saw appropriate, remembering always that they're legally responsible for their own actions. So that's basically what a guild could do. I would like to hear Matthew's take on that as somebody who actually practices.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an intriguing idea. And I think really the ideal healthcare system is less like the single payer monolithic NHS type system, and more like what you're describing in terms of understanding that the health of a community can't be separated from the health of individuals. And so if we're going to be taking care of people and their individual bodies, then we have to do it in a way that sort of recognizes the interactions they have with the community and doesn't simply sort of treat either medical practitioners or patients as kind of interchangeable cogs in the machine. Practically, the I think education would be education and standardization would be the hardest part of dealing with a guild system, you know, because for many states in America only have one or two medical schools in them. Mm. And so, when you talk about the resources necessary to train a doctor, a general, a family doctor like myself, yeah, I could see that happening on maybe the level of a county, but when it comes to training surgeons and more subspecialists, then in urban centers where communities, where many communities will be sharing one hospital, but they'll each be having their own primary care systems. I think that's a little trickier. But I do think, the thing that you touched on, so in that sense, it's maybe a little too extreme. Where I don't think you're extreme enough is in breaking up the doctor's cartel. I tell people I did not go to medical school for 4 years and do 3 years of residency to sit there and click boxes and order colonoscopies and order vaccines. And quite frankly, it's absurd that doctors are the only people that are able to do those sorts of things. And I think that there's a lot of, for the start, preventative care, a monkey with a checklist is capable of doing that. A computer is capable of doing that, and it's probably better. That some in a lot of these more centralized single payer systems, it is the computer that does it. They send you a little slip in the mail that says, "Hey, it's time for your mammogram," and so that way the doctor doesn't have to remember to order the mammogram, and doesn't have to fight with the computer that's flashing at him. That's just out of the the doctor's hands entirely. But I think also that we can train mid-level providers and especially community health workers, which is how they do it here in Africa, because they just don't have that many doctors, who are able to treat common illnesses, help deliver preventive care, and also to engage with communities around the health, the health issues that they're facing, and work with people to deal with the behavioral issues that affect their health, because those, I've heard that 40% or so of diseases, at least in the U.S., have some behavioral component, so smoking, eating too much, not enough exercise, all those kinds of things, seeing a doctor for 15 minutes once every 3 months is not a very efficient or effective way to try to convince someone to quit smoking or deal with some other behavioral issues. But, if there's a community health worker, someone that, you went to middle school with that you know and trust and who knows you and knows your community, then, that person is going to be more effective, I think, and be able to sort of have the longitudinal relationships and regular contact that allows them to deal with those behavioral issues that contribute to health, either positive or negative.
Well, I think the comparison there to third world countries with community health workers are probably a bigger addition than, cancer surgeons to the health of the nation. I think that's true in this country as well. We need more community health workers, not doctors, mm-hmm. community health workers. And that is, I think, something that guilds can do, providing their own training. And the community health care workers can do two things. They can increase the local knowledge of health. among the people, and they can serve as kind of triage. So this needs to be elevated. This doesn't. You don't need to go to the doctor for this. You need a, you know, you need a cup of chicken soup is what you need. But also spreading the health, spreading knowledge, because the real doctor that most of us first see is mama, and mama needs to be properly trained. So that's another function, because healthcare isn't just a part of the healthcare system. It's part of the food system. It's part of the education system. I mean, you think today, problems of obesity, problems of, which has both a component of the wrong kinds of food and a component of no exercise, because all of our children are sitting in front of screens and interacting with some socially and educationally dubious materials. It's a problem that exceeds the medical system per se. And the medical system per se needs to exceed itself and maybe treat, especially some communities in our countries, as if they were underserved communities in some other countries, because in a lot of places it is in other countries. Amen to the community health workers.
I'd like to tie that into, though, even some recent events, at least in a bleak way. You know, with the shooting, the latest Rampage shooting that we had down in Texas. You know, when I've talked about gun control with folks, you know, I've always tried to maintain, and I don't seem to get anywhere because I think people just they want to do something. But I've always maintained that, you know, whether it's the suicides that you find in the rural areas or the gun crime that you find in the inner cities or the Rampage shooters wherever, that it's not the gun violence itself that is the problem. But I have always thought that those are symptoms of a society that is sick. And it seems to me that my response to that would be I'd want to bolster this social good we're talking about as a means to reduce those. And I think gun violence is a metric for our health, whether it be mental or physical or just societal. And I think that there's some real merit to this approach with this guild system that, our focus is on a social good and it's on community health, and a lot of these other things would go away. I mean, is that what do you guys think of that thought?
Yeah, I mean, people who study gun violence like to talk about it as a public health problem because it has elements of contagion. The higher the concentration of people who are committing gun violence or on the receiving end of it in an area, the more it's going to spread and the more severe it's going to be. And if you can sort of treat and remove certain, people who are really spreading it around, as it were, you can really reduce violence. You mentioned suicides. You know, that's a huge issue of mental health and having access to those resources. And I think, if we could snap our fingers and make all the guns go away, then we could probably, we would reduce gun violence. Practically speaking, that would be very, very difficult. And when you look at the data, the things that are most effective in reducing gun deaths tend to be public health type interventions, whether that's trying to reach out to, most of which is reaching out to people who have the potential to misuse a firearm, whether it's, they are having mental health issues themselves and They're at risk for hurting themselves or other people, and making sure that that underlying problem is dealt with. Or, you know, people who are, you know, just committing violence because that's what they've learned and that's how you survive in your neighborhood. And, you know, you offer that person holistic services and job and connect them with their family and making sure they get health care and all those kinds of things. Those are more effective. Those are the most effective interventions that we have in front of us.
Which is the social pathology thing that you were speaking of earlier, Mr. Badai, correct?
Exactly. I think it really is a subject that should be an issue that should be the subject of epidemiological studies. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. Congress has prevented the CDC from studying gun violence as an epidemiological issue. Matthew, I think, is exactly right. Guns are not the problem, but guns make every other problem worse.
Mm-hmm.
A suicide, a person who slits his wrist, may change his mind, stop the bleeding, and get to a doctor. But a person who puts a bullet in his head can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is worse with a gun in your hand. The gun is not the problem, but it sure makes that problem final. But obviously, what happened here in Texas a few days ago, this was obviously a very disturbed person. And it's very true also that the person who ran the truck through the crowd shouting Aloha Akbar, that's also a mental health problem, okay? It just gets associated with Islam because a person, a Muslim with that particular mental composition, then takes the religion as a justification. But I think it's more likely that he had the same problem his fellow in Texas did. And you look at this opioid problem, you look at any number of other social measures, you're finding a society that is disassociating from itself. All the natural connections are dissolving. And that's perhaps the most serious problem that any nation can have. Mental health, physical health, is just one piece of that. And it really needs some more soul searching for these common goods which bind us together, of which healthcare is one, but not the only one.
Yeah. Yeah. Loneliness is an independent risk factor for death the older you get.
I'm sorry, say that again.
And people who rate themselves as very lonely have a statistically significantly higher risk of death.
Mm-hmm.
People joke about there's an older study, I think, that married men are like twice as likely as divorced men to survive a heart attack, and that's because, you know, the wife will say, no, I'm taking you to the doctor. But I mean, there's more and more evidence accumulating that the more atomized you are and the more separated you are from regular human contact and people that love you and care about you and are good for you, the more likely you are to die or get seriously ill.
Yes. At base, the real problem is love.
Mm-hmm.
And when we stop loving each other, you know, in a practical way, in making actual human connection, everything starts to fall apart. And in fact, that's what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mr. Madai, one of the things that I have talked with you about before, you know, just via via Facebook or whatever, was you have always kind of maintained that when everything breaks down or when things start to break down, that distributism will kind of rise from the ashes because it's the natural order of things. You know, it's communities doing things for themselves and organizing, self-organizing. Now, so I wonder if we're actually starting to see this a little bit in the healthcare realm. And I don't know a lot about this. I've seen stories on it, and I'm hoping Dr. Loftus can speak to it as well. But I have a friend out in Washington State, and at least for their the way that they are compliant with the ACA, which I guess you really don't need to be anymore too much, but the way they are compliant with it is they have put their money into one of these, you know, I guess some people call it concierge service, but essentially they have a family doctor on retainer for like $100 a month per person in their family, which is relatively inexpensive. And, you know, they get unlimited visits, very inexpensive x-rays, what have you. I mean, you know, I don't know the specifics right now, but I'm sure you've seen these and it sounds like a heck of a deal. But when they told me about this, I thought immediately, like, man, this sounds like the guilds, being created from the ground up. So Dr. Loftus, have you heard of these? Is there some truth to this?
Oh yeah, no, it's a big movement. it's called direct primary care. The myth is that it's only for rich people, because some of the, you know, some of the retainers do get pretty pricey. I do think it's a great model because, you have your doctor on call. That's the person that you know and, you know, that your family knows and whoever else is in their practice. And then from the perspective of the healthcare market, there's two ways for, you know, poorer people who are uninsured. The doctor kind of works with, you know, has a lab that they like to work with or, they try to find ways to get the cheapest drugs possible. When you're uninsured, there is a little bit of price negotiation that goes on. That's probably where consumers ironically, are most able to bargain when they don't have an insurer middleman doing it for them or not doing it for them, as the case may be. And I think that sort of system really would work well for a lot of, again, basic preventive and, you know, chronic care. I would say probably the best place where it would work is for chronic care of especially complex diseases, you know, people who have diabetes and hypertension and bipolar disorder and, you know, an arrhythmia. But again, the question is, how do you scale it up? How do you subsidize the people that need it? And then, what do you do when you, you know, have a brain tumor and you need a brain surgeon?
As a business owner, because and we have a caller waiting. Don't go, caller. We'll get you there in a second. As a business owner, you know, I have a small business and I'm not in a position where I can afford healthcare for my employees. I just can't afford it. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. a system like this, I believe, gets me closer because I could quite possibly afford this concierge service for my employees. And then I would be a lot closer and it would probably be easier buying them a catastrophic plan to augment that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I think that model
starts
to get us close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and take this call. Pop on caller, you're on the air. What would you like to ask our team here?
Oh, I don't want to start any trouble. I was just going to say, either you have single payer, universal health care, or if you can't afford it, you die. Essentially, it's that simple. We can work around it any way we want to, but when it comes down to it, brass tacks, it's either do or don't situation. And when you look across the world at the cost, The fact that we're spending more and getting less becomes a problem. And if we continue to have these fights, not only will it get worse, but I think these companies will be further entrenched within the system and continue to pull out profits while people are just passing away generation after generation.
Well, that's the very definition of treating medicine as a market good. With a market good, some get it, some don't. So it's mm-hmm. like the iPhone, you know, those who have the money get it, those who don't, they don't do without. That's a little bit different when you're talking about heart surgery. People have gone for days without an iPhone, but I'll tell you what, heart's pretty important. So that's why the fundamental decision has to be made as to whether this is a market good or a social good.
And even with that, are we ever going to eliminate some medicine being a market good? I mean, there's going to be people that can always afford to pay.
Sure. I mean, and those bariatric surgery, you know, cosmetic surgeries, things like that are obviously, at least in many cases, market goods rather than social goods. But, you know, curing your child's illness, well, that ought to be a social good. And another thing you said about, you know, you're being a small businessman and you can't afford it. You shouldn't even have to pay any attention to this whatsoever. This puts a tremendous burden on businessmen. Mm-hmm. It should be a social service that the businessman doesn't need to worry about. This, if you do have a plan, it takes an awful lot of your time as a business manager, time you could be spending delivering the product or service that you went in business to provide. So just as an aid to small business, I mean, it doesn't make any difference for big corporations. They just set up another department. Who cares? But for small business, this having to worry about these things and having to make these decisions in a confusing welter of information and misinformation, it puts a tremendous burden on them. They shouldn't have, an important person shouldn't have to bear those burdens just to provide some unrelated service.
No, it's actually a competitive advantage for big business, really.
Right.
Because it, and that's the part that I think hurts. But on the other hand, you know, down at the small business level, you do care about your employees more, I think, or to some extent. And but yet you're powerless really to do anything.
Right. It shouldn't be your problem. It should be a social problem addressed socially and not put the burden on the entrepreneur. It's just an insane way of delivering it. It's only delivered that way through a historical accident that occurred in the United States and in no other place on the globe. It was an artifact of price controls, wage controls of World War II, and it just continued after that.
I do believe though, and you know whether I should have to pay for it or not, I think that this concierge movement and what I think is a forerunner to a possible guild system, you know, it might make it to where it is affordable, and it just wouldn't be that much of a deal. Now, critics of that approach, you know, I've brought it up before, but they will quickly try to turn the notion of having a guild into, oh, you're going to have all manner of quackery and there's no standards. So what do we say to that? Because I don't think that it has to be that way.
Well, I think there would, the problem where that is eliminated is in with the insurance that sets the standard. Okay. If you're killing people, you're going to have very high insurance costs, or you're just going to not have any carrier. You have to be put up your own insurance bond, and that gets prohibitively expensive. So those who have a good results are going to have lower insurance rates, And those who don't are just going to be driven out of business. Also, I wanted to mention another thing on what's happening with distributed systems growing up. So I know in Oklahoma, and I think in other places, what you find developing are cash-only clinics. They don't accept insurance. They don't accept government payments. They publish a price list. You can compare them. Often these prices are not much more than your deductible. So to set a bone or to remove an appendix, whatever it might be, there's a price list. And once you have that information, well, with a price list, it's a big aid to decision-making. So that's another thing that's growing up. And with doctors who just don't want to get into that whole insurance thing, that whole Medicare or the whole government thing, they do it this way. And of course, its drawback is that it's a market good, but insofar as the market good, at least it's a rational market good. So it's not the whole
right.
solution, but it's possibly a part of the solution.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think if people could.
Go ahead, Doctor.
You know, if people had control over the amount that Medicaid was spending on them every month, or that the federal government was subsidizing their employer sponsored insurance plan, you know, if they had that money and they could just take that money to the cash only clinic, I think that would be a much more efficient and less painful system than what we have now.
All right. Well, I think we're kind of near the end. We can kind of wrap up. We're almost at the end of the hour. I'm going to ask you guys one kind of open-ended question each. We'll start with you, Dr. Loftus. Right now, if you could just make one change to the system, what would it be?
I would allow community health workers to prescribe and treat basic common illnesses and administer preventive care.
You know, I will affirm that in this story, and I don't know, Mr. Bedai in the Army, how your medics were, but I can tell you that on ship we would have independent duty corpsmen, and even, you know, when I was a senior officer, the senior medical officer was a friend of mine as well, and I'd go see him if I needed something. But if he wasn't available, I didn't go to the number two doc because I just had some problems with that individual. I went to the senior chief, who was an independent duty corpsman, and I don't believe there's anything like that on the outside. I know there's nurse practitioners, but I believe an independent duty corpsman is even more high powered than that. And he could prescribe medicines. He wasn't a doctor, but he had a lot of authority. And I think a lot of folks in the Navy are certainly, you know, we're used to that approach, but I'm not sure I think there's some stuff you'd have to build some acceptance with just regular rank and file folks. Because
yeah.
Everyone just wants to see the doctor, and they think that they're getting mm-hmm. substandard care.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
one more point about that is that because, you know, because community health workers would have to follow, you know, formulas and checklists, they would end up saying no to a lot of people, and we wouldn't spend as much money on useless MRIs and drugs that people don't need and antibiotics that only, you know, induce resistance, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So there'd be some adjustment on all ends, but in the end, it would be better for all of us.
Okay, so Mr. Bedai, a little bit of time left. What would be the one thing you'd change if you could right now?
I'd separate R&D and the production of medicines. I'd replace patents with licenses. So you develop the cure for cancer, and instead of it being a monopoly product, you license it to anybody who's capable of producing it and willing to pay the license fee. What that does is, instead of medicine being delivered by monopolies, it's delivered by companies that compete on their ability to efficiently manufacture and distribute it. So there would be price competition in the drug market. At the same time, there would be a constant stream of income for R&D companies. So instead of a 15-year patent now, which gives you a monopoly right, you could have, say, 25 years in which you could license your medicines to any number of companies, and then you'd have a stream of revenue to support more research and development. That's the one change, because the thing I think the biggest cost we have to attack right now is the obscene prices of drugs.
Boy, and that's a I wanted to get into that because I know you can say a lot more to that, but we just ran out of time. So I'm glad you brought it up in the end. I think there's a lot to unpack there, and we could do a whole segment on another show just talking about that topic in and of itself. All right. Well, thanks, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Maybe we will do this again. I think we can probably pull some more strings, but it certainly was everything I wanted. Real quick, there were two other things I wanted to mention about you guys, because other articles out there that I want to recommend by these gents recently. So Mr. Madai has an article out there called A Prayer for Bo Bergdahl at the American Conservative. I highly recommend it. I really do. As a fellow veteran, I recommend you guys go find that article. And then Dr. Loftus has a very good article called Conservatism Fails to Act Responsibly over at Mere Orthodoxy. Check that out as well. I think you'll really be pleased with both of those articles. So thanks again, gents.
I read that. I'm sorry I didn't associate you with that article. It's an excellent article. Yes, indeed.
It was indeed. Yes. So, well, that's good. Good. I'm glad we connected the dots there. So thanks again, gents. Everyone, thanks for listening tonight. Don't know who's going to be on the next episode, but, you can follow us at the Dorothy Day Caucus Facebook page, and you'll find out. And with that, Whispering Jack will take us out, and this one's for my beautiful bride. So everyone have a great evening.
Thank you.
First time that I saw you, as you went passing by, I knew my searching days were through. Then I made my mind up that you would soon know why. That's when I started telling you, little girl, you're the one girl for me. Little girl, you're as sweet as can be. Just a glance at you meant love from the start. And oh, what a thrill came into my heart. Little girl, with your cute little ways, I am yours for the rest of my days. And this great big world will be divine. Little girl, when you're mine, all mine. And I'm just bubbling over, my heart is thrilled with pride to think you're in my arms tonight. I'll be happy always with you right by my side. Each day a new dream of delight. Little girl, you're the one girl for me. Little girl, say you're as sweet as can be. Just a glance at you meant love from the start. And oh, what a thrill came into my heart. Little girl, with your cute little ways, I am yours for the rest of my days. And this great big world will be divine. Little girl, when you're mine, all mine. Little girl, you're the one girl for me. Little girl, you're as sweet as can be. Just a glance at you meant love from the start. And oh, what a thrill came into my heart. Little girl, with your cute little ways, say I'm yours for the rest of my days. And this great big world will be divine. Little girl, when you're mine, all mine.